Hello, and welcome to Be Your Own Healer Telesummit. I'm Jonathan Fitzgordon, your host and founder of Core Walking, and I'm here today speaking with life coach Vanessa Scotto. Vanessa has a master's degree in counseling psychology and Chinese medicine. For the past 15 years, her innovative blend of neuroscience, psychology, and spiritual straight talk has helped hundreds of clients get past fear and inertia to live the life they really wanted. Her mission is to teach people how to build the inner architecture needed to expand to the fullest and get the most out of one's life. Welcome, Vanessa. I'm so pleased to talk to you today.
Hi, Jonathan. It's always great to be in contact with you.
Oh, thanks so much. What does the phrase, be your own healer, mean to you? And why is it important for people to heal themselves?
I think it's huge. You know, I think we're in a day and age where we get a lot of quote-unquote gurus out there prescribing a path, but I think what many of us recognize to be the truth, I mean, I know at least what I recognize to be the truth, is that although healers, helpers, guides can all be of assistance to us, the answers really do lie within. And sometimes, you know, like I did Chinese medicine, my needles are like an invitation for you to connect with your answers. Or my herbs were a way to restore balance so you can access yourself again. So sometimes you need a little bit of help from the outside, but ultimately if you don't connect with your answers from that deep place within, and if you don't become an advocate for your own health and wellness, well, nothing will really fit. And not only that, but you stay in what I guess I would call a disempowered state. You know, as long as we believe in the myth that healing comes from outside and someone else has the answers and they could save me, it's this myth and it's the state of being that encourages us to feel disconnected, disempowered, and sometimes even hopeless.
And how would you say your past or your personal history has informed how you're working with people now?
Well, you know, I would say that I was a peculiar kid. So, you know, my journey kind of started a long time ago. I was dreaming about reincarnation and weird stuff since I was young. And around 17 or 18, I found yoga, I found Buddhism. I always knew I wanted to help people. But what I would say is that somewhere in my 20s, I hit like a spiritual or psychological crisis. My life, for all intents and purposes, looked good. You know, I was married to a great guy. I had a great home. I had a business I liked. I was an acupuncturist at the time. I owned a healthcare center. You know, there was really nothing that should be wrong, only I was constantly anxious. I didn't feel, like, deeply content the way one would think my circumstances might elicit me to. I didn't really feel that grateful, to be honest, even though rationally, I understood I had everything one could need to feel great and more. And, you know, when I really got deep into probing that, I did life coaching, therapy, energy work, acupuncture, you know, yoga. I tried all sorts of different modalities. When I really got deep into probing that, it became clear that there were some issues around feeling worthy, feeling lovable. There was a lot of pain from my past that I hadn't really acknowledged or metabolized. And one of the things that I think happens is when we have this amount of pain that we don't know how to deal with, or we have these painful beliefs, like I'm not worthy is one of the most painful beliefs we can have, we start to disembody. You know, in psychology, we say we start to dissociate. But the experience is we're constantly trying to, like, leave the moment, leave ourselves. We put all of our hope in the future, a future moment, into our thoughts. And until we can land in our body, we can't find the answers. We can't be our own healer. So I think for me, a lot of my journey back to health, towards contentment, towards self-love, towards presence, was finding a way to metabolize all of those things and let go of some of those ideas that I had that were erroneous so I could once again inhabit my body. Does that make sense?
No, absolutely. You were born in Brooklyn as well, right?
I was born in Brooklyn, moved to Queens, and then journeyed back to Brooklyn.
Oh, that's great. Yeah, like I tell people that when, for me, growing up in Brooklyn, there was no sign of what was to come in my life. Like, it wasn't that it wasn't a spiritual place, but it was just a kind of hard place. And I grew up in a time that was, you know, not the easiest of places to grow up. Like, when you were really young, I love that you started having these ideas and kind of dreams really early. What did you want to be when you grew up, when you were really young?
I knew I wanted to help people. I had a little phase where I wanted to be an architect, and I really, really stunk at physics, so I dropped it. But I always knew I wanted to do something that helped people. And it, when I look back now, I think it's sort of amazing that a young child had that thought. And I think in some ways it describes my natural aptitude, and in some ways it describes a pathology, like a piece of myself that had taken on the burden or role of caretaking from such a young stage that I almost believed that I had to do it to, you know, earn my worth, like earn my keep here.
I know you wear a lot of hats, right? You're an acupuncturist and herbs and Chinese medicine. What do you identify yourself as anything particularly now? Like, are you a healer, a teacher, a coach, a guide?
Gosh, I think it's such a confusing thing to sort through, even for myself. I think teacher and guide are the two things I identify with the most. I've been a Chinese medicine doctor, and I call myself a life coach, although I admit I even hate the term. It just doesn't sink. And I think that there's this combination of teaching and guiding because, you know, what we were saying before, the answers really are within people. I can teach you, though, some skills and some tools to be able to cut through just the rational mind, you know, the conscious forefront that is repetitive and redundant, and often it's recycling other people's ideas, or it's recycling outdated beliefs that you have. So I can teach people skills and tools to cut through that so they can answer some more of the questions for themselves. But ultimately, I think I'm just a guide. I'm a guide back to who you are and a guide back to the present moment.
You know, I think the term life coach gets a bad rap. And I fall into the same exact category where I didn't know much about it, and I just looked on it with derision and was happy to make jokes about it. And but in the last year and a year and a half, I've watched my wife study to become a coach, and I'm in the apartment listening into her conversations with clients, and I have to say it's a profound first of the change. You know, for me, a lot of this stuff, we'll get to it, is about the willingness to change. You know, and for me, I really have changed my idea of exactly what a life coach is, and it's been a really great experience to really see what you guys do in terms of facilitating people and what you're able to get to the heart of and cut through. It's really that's been an amazing experience, even though I probably shouldn't be listening in on my wife's calls.
I think facilitation is really the key. I mean, as much as I don't like the words, I myself am trained as a psychotherapist. I went through training and I decided not to go on to licensure. And I did an apprenticeship in life coaching. And it was really useful to me. I think some of why I personally don't love the words is that, well, first, I don't relate to coach itself. It sounds too like rah-rah, like you're standing on the sidelines. But when I studied life coaching, there was a lot of goal orientation, like who do you want to be, how are you going to get there, and breaking it down into tangible modules. And I think that that's useful. I think that's important. But until we can reconnect with our own inner healer, until we can reconnect with what our voice of wisdom and intuition really is, and until we can learn to be more present, then where are those goals even coming from? And so many people start to reach those goals, but they don't feel a difference in their internal state. I mean, I think you and I are very clear. Happiness doesn't come from what you get, what you do, or what you have. Those are all nice things. They can complement us. They're pleasurable. But, you know, someone can reach their dream of being a CEO of a company and be perfectly unhappy. So I think that when we start to recognize that, the best form of help I think we can receive is the facilitation, those those deep intuitive questions that help you go deeper and deeper into your process, that's one powerful thing. And combine that with an empathetic human being who's really listening and mirroring us, those two things combined make a powerful place for healing and transformation to happen. But ultimately, it's us doing it. You know, I actually coach a lot of people who are in the helping profession. And whenever I'll say, like, oh, who's your favorite client? Who do you like to work with? It almost always comes up with the people who are introspective enough to sort of self-guide and to create the steps in their own lives. Because really, that's what, when they look at psychology, they find it's not the form of psychology that's the most impactful in terms of how effective it is for people to change. It's actually who can tune in with introspective and self-awareness so that they can create, like, mind-body aha experiences.
It's really great. So then it's, you know, I'll often talk about, and when I teach people to walk and I work with back pain, that I am a guide, and it's a co-journey, that we're taking the journey together, that this journey towards change. So I really love that perspective of their insight coupled with your insight. And the key word, I think, is empathy. It's really great. You know, like, where I don't – you kind of have to be an empath to be in this business. And you kind of, as I don't think you, as a person looking to a practitioner, I don't always think you, they have a sense of how much the empathy is going to mean in terms of their healing.
Right.
You know, and I love body work. I love my acupuncturist and my chiropractors, and I don't plan on ever not doing that kind of work, but it's only one piece of the puzzle. How much responsibility does the individual have when it comes to healing themselves or getting fixed?
I mean, ultimately, it's, I would say all, but that's probably being a little bit overgeneralized, because, you know, if you're in good hands, you can progress and evolve very quickly. And if you're in the wrong hands, somebody else has the ability to limit where you evolve, or maybe even, let's say, create a bit more stickiness in some of your patterns. And I think when we talk about empathy, what occurs to me is sometimes we're such an individualistic culture that we forget that we're interconnected. And not just like there's an idea that we're interconnected, like, oh, we live together, but we are literally linked energetically. And this has been shown in quantum theory all along. I mean, this isn't just an esoteric way of looking at the world. We're connected, and psychology has a basic idea that wounds were created in relationships. You know, we're born these kind of beautiful blank slates, and, you know, obviously depending on your philosophy, maybe we were born with some temperament or some karma or whatever you think. But essentially, we're born here, and we have this blank slate, and wounds happen in relationship with people. So then the best way to heal those wounds, those psychological wounds, is again in relationship with people. And we're connected. So when someone sits in front of me, I'm very well aware that if I judge their experience, if I put their experience down, if I even just put a lot of my opinion into the mix at the wrong moment in time, it will influence them, especially if they don't feel entitled to their own wisdom. You know, so many of us were domesticated by our families or our cultures at a young age to think that our answers or our ideas aren't valid. So in the big picture, I think ultimately it always depends on the person. And trying to break someone free from that victim mentality that the answers lie outside, which is so huge in our culture, is definitely part of the work that I do. And who you sit with and who you open up to and who you share your journey with can have an influence on how you heal and evolve or how you get further entrenched into your own painful beliefs.
It's an amazing dynamic about, and this has come up a couple of times in these interviews, in terms of how do you find your way to the right person, and how much the idea is amazing to me that you're an individual in pain, whether it's physical or psychological, or whatever. But you're looking for someone to help you, and you manage to find yourself to someone who's really not healthy enough to help you. And they actually want control, whatever their journey is, whatever their karma is, as a therapist or a coach or anything. And you can get really wrapped up in the wrong end of the journey if you don't have the instincts to know if your quote-unquote healer is the right one for you.
Wow, that's right. It's actually such a really good question. I never thought it through before. You know, on the one hand, of course, if we're in pain and we're disconnected from some aspects of ourselves, it makes it sometimes even more challenging to feel into what feels right. But what I can offer is that when you're with the right person, in whatever modality it is, you will feel felt, and you will feel heard, and you will feel seen. And that doesn't mean you will feel enabled. You know, I did the walking program with you so long ago, and I had issues around building my core. And they weren't just bodily issues. They're deep, underlying, psychological, somatic issues all mingled into one. And you wouldn't enable my issue and say, oh, sure, then don't do anything. But you can, with your experience and your empathy, just mirror, like, wow, I get that. That must have been painful. And so I think that if you feel like someone is above you, in the sense that you're idolizing them, that's a good thing to question, because that usually comes with a power differential that's only going to feed the idea that you're disempowered. I think that if you don't feel that the person is actually feeling you and receiving you, and you don't experience yourself as opening more and more and relaxing into your body more and more, it's certainly worth at least calling into question if you found someone who's present with you and genuinely caring about your healing journey, or if you found someone who's more invested in their role as the caretaker or the helper. Because when people are really invested in helping, quote unquote, they'll pull a healthy out of the client. Does that make sense?
Oh, absolutely. And it's such an interesting, you're so vulnerable when you're looking for that healer. And one of the things I talk about often, I don't understand how, you know, using the word the psychologist or even an acupuncturist, a chiropractor, how we don't really interview people, right? Like, mm-hmm. if you're a boss and you're going to hire someone to handle the public and to be your representative to the public, you're going to interview them maybe once, maybe twice, but then you're going to go to somebody who's a psychotherapist or even an acupuncturist, massage person, and we just kind of go on a certain faith, oh, they are in that world, they are going to do right by me, I think it's very easy to give your power up to people who are in our field.
It's true, it is, it's funny, I always do an intake with people first, like a pre-consult, always, because there's just, you know, certain vibes where two people don't click, or maybe what they're looking for help on isn't really my sweet spot and there's someone who would be better for them. So I always interview people, and I always get a little, like, excited when someone says, I'm interviewing 4 life coaches.
Oh, that's great.
And, yeah, and to the outside, it may seem like, oh, they're so anal, they're so – but you're,
right.
I mean, this is, like, it's our whole well-being. It's our body, it's our mind, it's our spirit, whatever it is. This is important. It's worth taking the time until you feel that connection. And I don't know if you've had this, but I've had people who connect with me so deeply. They said, I've never felt like this before, but you're not covered by my insurance. And I'm like, well, you know what? Like, you got to follow this. So, I mean, there's a couple of dilemmas in this area.
The money piece is a fascinating thing for me, because I came to what I do as a yoga student who got really interested in yoga. Like, I'm very much rooted in being a Jewish kid from Brooklyn, but I got interested in yoga, and I was able to do the asana, the physical part of yoga, really well, really easily, and found that it was you know, it made me an egomaniac more than anything. And I discovered my way into service and to karma yoga. And, you know, and service takes on all different forms. And then you go into this, the make a living piece of service. And I don't ever want to turn anyone away. And if you're in pain and you have back pain, I'm going to work with, it's on my website. You know, if you don't have money, I'll give you my program for free. But there is a whole piece in our world about that's not a good way to perform, right? That, and I don't disagree with it. I'm really on the fence and confused about it. The idea that if someone is not paying for something, it is, they're not going to have the same attention to the work they're going to do. And I know a lot of people feel about insurance, that insurance people, if your insurance covers it, it enables you to not really invest completely in the work. And I honestly, for me, I'm really confused about the nature of serving people but having yet and needing to get paid, even though, you know, I'm definitely here to make a living. It's part of the entrepreneurial life.
Yeah, it's really confusing. I mean, one would say that once you're dependent upon your client paying you as your source of income, like maybe it would cloud your judgment, cloud your understanding. But at the same time, you know, I think this is actually one of my really important life lessons. I it sounds crazy, but on some deep cellular level, believed that my job, I had to like earn the right to breathe and take up space by helping people, which is much different than just experiencing like, oh, I'd like to be of service in the world and give back. It's more of a role or something like that. And I think as I've gone through life, what I realized was life is about giving and receiving, right? It's our inhale, exhale. You can't have one part without the other. And if you think you're not receiving, that's also a myth. I have a lot of people who experience that. But to a certain extent, I think that people who are in the caring professions need to learn how to receive, like how to really drink in on a somatic, on a cognitive, and on a spiritual level, abundance. So the way that, and I've had to talk myself through this, just like you were saying, I talked myself through this by saying we're all interconnected. There is energy in the world, and it's important that I receive, because anytime I haven't charged enough for my time or I've given it away when I didn't feel like I either had it to give or that it wasn't right to give, anytime that's happened, sooner or later, a little resentment creeps in, a little like, I can't believe I'm spending my time like this, and I hate to admit it, but it has. So someone once told me that when you have a boundary, that a boundary protects not only you, but the person from you. And money is a boundary. In this sense, it says, you're powerful, I'm powerful. You give me, I give you. We are equals and we have an exchange. And I'm telling you that this makes me comfortable. When you give me this much, I'll give you that much. And in this way, it protects them from us feeling like, oh God, what an energy vampire, or poor me, I have to always give, you know, any of that stuff. I'm trying not to curse. Any of that stuff that can circulate through us. And it also lets them feel powerful and invested. I mean, I know you know that so much of the problem is people will spend money on, you know, clothes, food, restaurants, drinks, you know, stuff like that, only to feel like they don't have it for their wellness. So it's also allowing them to prioritize.
And absolutely, and I actually also feel that people aren't always ready to heal. Like one of the, you know, people come into me and I look at them and I go, whoa, you really are in need of what I do. Or if I do release work, you know, and I say, oh, you know, do this thing and it's traumatic release work and it's going to be really powerful. And they come back and they go, oh, wow, I felt nothing. Like that was meaningless experience for me. And I had to start looking and going, well, you know, maybe your body is not ready to let go of whatever it needs to let go of, and we would both acknowledge that there's stuff that needs to be let go of, but maybe it's just not ready. And to me, that's been a very interesting process in letting people be and letting people heal as they need to heal.
I love that. I mean, I know firsthand, as I was saying when I worked with you, I have something about my core. Oh, Lord, I don't want to strengthen those muscles. And I knew right away this wasn't just physical. Yes, there's a weakness there and it's harder, but I knew right away it wasn't just physical. There's something very deep to this. And as patients, as clients, we have to be sometimes very loving and kind and patient with ourselves, which is hard. But also, you know, I had an interesting experience with a client the other day where she, you know, reached a plateau in her work with me. She noticed it more than me, more than I noticed it. She noticed it. And what it really came down to, in a sense, is I'm taking her somewhere. I'm trying to take her into a recognition of her own inner goodness, of her own, like, innate goodness. And she has no reference for that. She has no reference for that realization. No one in her world ever mirrored that she was good when she was young. I don't think her parents had that reference either. You know, they didn't hurt her out of no reason. They didn't have that reference either. And so sometimes that kind of new information is so foreign to someone, or even so threatening, because it shakes apart the fabric of who they identify themselves as or how they think the world works, that it's like they just turn off to it. Like, your cells can only be in on, which is responsive mode, or off, which is shut down mode. And if the information is so foreign or so threatening, then they'll turn off to it, and then nothing can change. We can't change when we're turned off.
Hello?
Oh, did we lose? Did you hear me finish? I'm sorry.
No, I think it cut out for a minute, a couple of seconds. You know, like, the word threatening, and I also think it's scary, right? That you're doing your work and you're getting them to a place, and then the closer they get to a place of insight, the scarier it gets, and that fear is driving everybody. And to me, very often it makes sense that people need to back off and not go there. The whole idea for me is hopefully they do get to go there when they're ready.
That's right. And I think what you just exhibited is empathy, and it's loving kindness, and it's making space for someone to have their process. And that leaves an impression on the client. You know, when you can say, like, maybe you're not ready to go here yet, maybe you need a different kind of support, because sometimes it's just they're done talking to me. They just need something different at that moment. Whatever the case is, but with that energy of loving kindness and genuine patience and a genuine sense of it's okay. Like, we're not fixer-uppers, we're humans. And it is a journey. And there's a reason why we're stuck where we're stuck, whether it's our bodies or our minds or our spirits. And it's almost always because there's something scary or that was hard for us to deal with underneath. And so that kind of loving kindness leaves an impression. And then the person who you're interacting with can allow that impression to affect them. And if that's what they walk away with, this sense that it's okay and that they should accept themselves wherever they are and that there's hope and that they don't have to rush or push, if they can walk away with that, you've already enacted something powerful. And then I think as practitioners, we just have to trust that they have their own agency, they have their own timing, they have their own rhythm, and we believe that if they keep staying curious, something will always unfold.
Yeah, that's the dynamic. I mean, it's really what makes my work so much fun for me, and it's not that I don't love teaching yoga, but teaching yoga can be a very similar process. You know, I'm doing my thing for 90 minutes, and it's a social experience, and it's just pure, pure joy. But the client practitioner journey, the really coming together to have a relationship, that's just, it's incredibly thrilling, even though it doesn't always work out the way you want, and sometimes people can't accomplish. It's really, it's amazing, and it definitely keeps me on my toes.
Yeah,
is there anything like,
right,
in, you know, in terms of what people need to do and how much you advise, is there anything that's not in your purview? Are you willing to go into lifestyle choices and diet? And is there anything you don't approach in terms of helping people?
I believe that we don't have to be everything to everyone. So there, I will sometimes talk about diet because of my background in Chinese medicine. I will sometimes talk about lifestyle choices because I have a holistic perspective and a lot of experience in my field. But, you know, there are people who do diet better than me. I don't talk about somatic stuff very often, although sometimes I'll slip into like, well, if you have hip pain, you shouldn't sit like this because I can't help it. It's still the doctor in me. But I think that there are always people who are better suited to help because they specialize and make their life that understanding. And I think the best thing that we can do is not be narrow in our focus so that we stay open to the idea that, you know, one of the reasons why I didn't want to be a therapist was I would deal with people with panic disorders. I didn't want to talk about their childhood. I wanted to talk about how they ate. And sometimes I'd find out that they didn't eat for 8 hours, and then no wonder they were having a panic attack. So if we stay open in our perspective, realizing that someone's posture can affect their cognition, that how someone eats can affect their ability to be present, that some of their beliefs can affect their ability to walk well. If we stay open as practitioners to that, so that I can say, well, maybe there's something going on that I can't help with or I can't see, and I can refer them out or at least be understanding when they bring that into the room, I think that's the best that we can do.
Oh, that's great. This goes back a little bit to what you were saying about being a coach. I feel like one of the main things I'm trying to share with people is just that you can change, right? That you don't have to settle for what you feel or what you do. But I feel sometimes like I'm a cheerleader, you know, like I'm there to believe in you when you're in full of doubt. How much cheerleading would you say is involved with what you do?
Oh, I mean, a ton. You know, one of the most painful things people go through is hopelessness and despair, and it's prevalent. You know, when I hit my crisis in my 20s, I was despairing, actually. I would hit moments where I'd fall into despair, and it was not a usual place for me to be in. And so when people are hopeless or in despair, I think of us, like, as a bridge. Like, in that moment, I'm a bridge to a different experience. So even though it sounds like I'm cheerleading, really it's more that I'm embodying a belief and a state as a bridge so that they could then feel into my experience of belief and faith in them and hopefully then allow that same field of experience to resonate in their body. Does that make sense?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. No, it's great because in talking to you, you bring all your hats to your dialogue, right? you really do. You bring all of your training in, which is really great to hear. You know, how often is healing painful? Like, or is there value to pain, or do you have to have pain to heal?
Yeah, I almost think it's a must, and only because of this. It's only a must because we are whole. It's the beliefs and the patterns that block us from experiencing that. And a lot of times it's us disconnecting from ourselves or disembodying, as I said before, that leads to pain, at least of the psychological, spiritual kind. So the only way through it is through it. When people have to come back into their body, there's all sorts of unmetabolized experience or moments of pain that will necessarily come up. But now we're not kids anymore, or hopefully we're not in that same moment of trauma that created it. So then we can start to learn tools of resiliency. So even though it's painful, we finally get to learn how to tolerate, metabolize, and release this experience and build up the skills to deal with more in the future. But I will say this. This was one of my problems with school when I went to school as a therapist, is that when you look, let's say, in the brain neurologically, if you want to go from depression to neutral, that's one loop of the brain. We can learn how to go from depression to neutral. But if you want to learn how to be joyful, ecstatic, blissful, happy, loving, all of those different things, it's a different neural circuit. So it's not like if we just talk about all the pain in your life, you're going to learn how to be happy. So we need to bring that into the dialogue as well. I'm very clear with my clients of not just talking about their pain, but also looking at what lights them up, what makes them feel alive, when they feel good in their body, how to find compassion for themselves and others, and all of those different things that help you expand. Because if life doesn't feel good and you don't believe it can, then where's the motivation to deal with the pain? You're just going to want to give yourself as much momentary pleasure as you can, because otherwise life doesn't feel good enough. So you need to give someone something to hold on to so they'll bear with the transformational, painful experience.
That's great. I mean, that's the guiding process. You know, one of the, you know, what I do is interesting because I'm not a psychologist at all, and yet I work with back pain and people, or in hip pain, knee pain, you know, all different kinds of pain for the most part. And people will come in, and I do, you know, fairly gentle release work, trauma release work, and I feel like I can look at your body and I can see it. You know, it's there. Very often people want to start telling me their story, and I'm like, no, I'm not, you know, that's not my purview. It's not my game. But I do want, I feel like I'm trying to help them uncover the root of their physical problem, which sometimes is physical, sometimes is emotional. But again, like I said, it's the detective work that really makes my job so much fun. How much of that kind of detective work is involved in your practice?
I mean, it's everything, right? As you said, what makes it fun is it's always a mystery. You know, we are mysteries even to ourselves half the time, and certainly to one another. And I just stay curious with my clients. I mean, that's a lot of the work that you do. It's funny, you know, maybe you've experienced this in your life. I don't know. I'm that person that people just want to open up to. Like I'm at a party and someone starts telling me, you know, all of their stories. And when I used to wonder about that, it's simply this, not enough people are curious. So when you're with somebody and I'm there and I'm genuinely curious and present, but not scared and not probing and demanding, then they start to become simply curious themselves and hopefully gently curious. And you just keep going in deeper and deeper, little by little, and stuff starts to make itself known. And I'm not sure that we always have to understand the cause. You know, even just you mirroring the pain in that moment without getting to the root of the trauma can be super useful. But, you know, usually when our mind can connect the dots to say, ah, this is how I became who I am, it's shown that there is some power in terms of them feeling psychologically healthy and grounded and happy.
And just to go back to the beginning of that, I don't think you can make yourself into an empath. I think you have that thing, and I have no idea. Honestly, like I started doing what I did do really late, and I have no idea why I do what I do in a lot of ways, even though I love it so much, you know. And I have a story from my not childhood, but you know, probably 20s or 30s, when a friend, I was hanging out with this friend of mine, and she, just like you said, she just telling me all her deepest, darkest secrets, and I'm sort of sitting there going, why tell me? Like, I have no responsibility to people, and I'm like, you know, I'm a loud mouth and I talk too much. Why are you telling me this? So,
right.
She went to another friend of ours and said, I can't stop telling Jonathan these secrets, and he goes, oh, he's an empath. You can't help yourself. And
right.
I had never thought of myself that way. That wasn't my perception. I was, a carpenter and a waiter. And and I asked him, and he goes, no, it's just who you are. You know, it's just like you have this thing. And his take was non-judgmental. He was like, you know, people start talking to you, and they don't feel judged, so they just want to tell you more.
Yeah.
I always thought that was really interesting. And now I can totally connect to what that's all about in the work and where I've ended up.
I have to say that with empaths, I think you can train yourself to become more empathic, but there's some people where that's just their gift. It's just their zone of genius. But what I do work with a lot, I actually get a lot of empathic clients. It's kind of my sweet spot. I call it like the mystical misfit, because they're usually people who felt a lot and experienced a lot and thought very deeply, and they didn't always fit in culturally. But what I do work with empaths is how to hone their gifts more clearly and how to minimize the challenges. Because it's not always easy being an empath in a very overstimulating society. So I do a lot of work with empaths in particular.
Oh, I think that's really great, the idea of helping people maybe not put themselves out there so much. That's a pretty interesting line. You know, in terms of that exact thing, how much, what do you take on of your clients, or how much suffering of others do you take on, if any, in your work? And do you have a sense of what that is, and, or how do you work with that?
Yeah, I've been working on this for a long time. I would say I still take on a decent amount. It's so much better than I used to. You know, I was always that person, like, even when I did acupuncture, if they had knee pain, they left, I had knee pain. You know, it was like, there's like a resonance or something in my body. And, you know, to a certain extent, we have mirror neurons. I think what an empath is doing, often inadvertently, is we're feeling someone to get a picture of them, you know, and I feel people in my body. So I think that nowadays I do a lot more, like, grounding, meditation, energetic release. It sounds hokey, but I try to recognize, like, this is me, that's them. And I may even, like, do a meditation where I try to, like, release somebody's energy, because I find it to be confusing if you ask the question of, like, how do we do what we do? To a certain extent, back in the day, I used to lean forward. I could feel it. Like, if I could picture it energetically, and I think everyone listening can do this, picture how you're of service. Picture what you do in a room. And I used to lean forward energetically and then dive into someone's body to, like, look, like a detective. Like, I wanted to find the little piece that was causing the backup. And it took me a long time to learn to, like, stay in my seat and stay in my body. So now when I work with clients, I breathe into my body and I breathe into my heart and I keep grounding into my sacrum so that I know I'm not moving forward into their experience and losing my seat, because that's when you pick up on things. When we disembody, then there's like a vacuum and we begin to pick up on the thoughts, experiences, and feelings. But I just want to say, it sounds super hokey when we say all of it sometimes, but this is, like, in psychology, they call it emotional contagion. And it's been very clear, they talk about it in all fields and disciplines, we're interconnected. And if you overly try to understand someone by, like, moving too close towards them, then you can pick up on the thoughts, the feelings, and the somatic sensations that they carry.
No doubt. This goes back to what we were saying before about this, the idea of the patient just comes to you, and how lucky are they if you have actually done that work so that you can really serve them, because they don't know.
Huge.
You know, that's an amazing little dynamic. I know a lot of people in the kind of work we do have a tendency, or they can get a tendency, to not take care of themselves because they're so focused on others. Where do you fit in that? Do you find it easier to help others than yourself, or are you pretty good at taking care of yourself?
I'm pretty good at it at this point. Like, I have always been the person who took quarterly vacations, because I think we need those timeouts. You know, I work with coaches and therapists as I need them. I go get Rolf. I do it all, so I'm pretty good. Where I find the personal challenge is when my needs conflict with the needs of others in a way that becomes apparent to me. And that's the edge that I'm working through by recognizing, like, you know, we're all interconnected and we all have a right to be happy and sane. And when I give more than I can or than I'm comfortable with because someone else is needing it, I just remind myself that that doesn't serve them, it doesn't serve me, and it doesn't make me available for other people. So I would say that's my edge. I'm still strengthening my muscles around is how to stay true even when I perceive someone needs something different from me.
You know, and I think it's normal that, you know, we're often motivated by seeing the growth and changes in our clients. But what do you expect to your clients, or more to the point, like, how attached are you to their success?
I mean, I think it's human to admit that it feels good when they're thriving or when they're having like epiphanies and self-discoveries. It certainly feels good. I mean, it's not my job to heal them, but I'm certainly creating a space in which they're desiring healing. So it naturally, it feels good. I'm happy when they're happy. But what I really hope for people really is that they reconnect with themselves. Like the number one is that they reconnect with themselves. Like they can begin to feel into their body. They develop self-awareness, self-understanding, self-compassion, and they get a sense of their intuition and their knowing. That's like my number one. But I'll say the number two is when they start to recognize some of these like larger fundamental truths, like how not to take things personally because everybody's going through their own pain and it's not always about you. You know, like a lot of times what I notice is the first sign that someone's changing is when they don't take things so personally anymore. And they have like a lot more freedom when that happens. So I'm very patient. I'm very compassionate. I think these things can take time. But I know it's like if A, then B. If someone stays genuinely curious and present with themselves, things will always unfold. Always. I just can't predict how and when. So as long as I see they're still curious and they're still on their journey, I feel pretty good about that.
Yeah. You know, I'd say there's a fine line between enabling and guiding. You know, how do we tell the difference? And do you ever feel like you're doing the work for them or that they just won't do the work? And how do you work around that?
Well, in this case, it's a little hard for me to do the work for them. I mean, I can say, oh, I think it's because of X, Y, and Z, and in a sense, that could be doing the work for them. But it's a lot harder than, let's say, an acupuncture, where I really could enable someone because I could keep making their back pain better without them ever dealing with the root of why they had back pain to begin with. But in this case, I do think that it's important. Where I find the problem is, when are you being overly patient and compassionate and understanding to the point that it's what Buddha calls idiot compassion? You know, like, when are you sympathizing with a part of them that's really just an old pattern or an unconscious part that's hijacking them? So it's how do you find that place of honest compassion where you really root for the parts of them that are most holistically beneficial, as opposed to sympathizing or having compassion just for the parts that are recreating the wounding.
That's great. You know, I'm always curious to know what alternative practitioners think about allopathic medicine. You know, in our Western medical model, it very often doesn't include an awareness of other healing modalities. It's just, you know, standard. I talk to people that have been, people don't come to me for walking lessons until they've gone to a lot of other people for the most part, you know. So, and then I just hear what their doctors say, and very often a lot of Western, not all by any means, but a lot of Western doctors are just not going to be willing to step outside of the Western box. And I know that you have a ton of training in Eastern disciplines. How willing are you to step out of the Eastern box and recommend allopathic medicine?
I mean, I will. Everything has its place, right? So I think that allopathic medicine is useful for certain conditions. It's useful in certain moments of crisis. I think even having diagnostic information can be useful. Like if I understand that I blew out my L4 disc, that just gives information for my acupuncturist to focus their treatment even more effectively. So I will recommend to allopathic. In my particular field these days, where it comes into view the most is the conversation of antidepressants and anti-anxiety medication. Right. And do I recommend them? And, you know, I would say 9 times out of 10, I don't, because when they look at depression, they find that 2% of depression only is endogenous and needs lifelong treatment. Yet the way that our culture treats it and the psychiatrists treat it is like once you're on medication, you have to stay on medication for life. And that is absolutely not grounded in scientific understanding. So I don't often recommend it. However, what I have noticed is if someone is so beleaguered by either depression where they can't function, they can't get out of bed, or anxiety where they can barely breathe, or they're beginning to engage in unhealthy or compulsive choices, until they can find some measure of ground or ease, they can't do the psychological work. You know, think about it. Like, if you're in a state of panic, it's very hard to shift your mind or to understand a new perspective. This is not how the body works. Like, we're not absorbing new material. So at those moments, I may recommend, I don't recommend, but if someone asks, I will feel supportive towards them doing a short course of something while they're engaging alternative methodologies like exercise and counseling or whatever they may need, so that they can finally find their feet and then they can actually enact some of the things that will create a real change.
That's just great. You know, Vanessa, this has been a great dialogue for me and super fun. So just as a final, like, takeaway, what do you think are the most important first steps for someone to take when they want to get on the road to being their own healer?
You know, I actually think self-compassion is a really big thing. It's like if someone was to keep judging you, you wouldn't admit the truth to them and you wouldn't want to share who you were with them. I think too often, and this is true for the empath community, introspective people tend to be highly analytical and highly self-critical. So I think that until we can learn some gentleness and some self-compassion, it can be hard to see some of the shadow material or some of the beliefs or some of the painful incidents that might be keeping us stuck. So finding a technique around self-compassion, which there's plenty in Buddhism, I have it on my page, you can find psychologists, like, there's a lot of work on self-compassion, but beginning to explore some of that and then taking that energy of gentle curiosity and kindness into whatever other modality you may need to support and guide you is the best way to begin any experience.
Thank you so much, Vanessa. This has been just a great dialogue. And
thank you, Jonathan. So much fun.
Super fun. For more information on Vanessa Scotto, you can go to her website, vanessascotto.com. And everyone, have a great day.
Thanks, everyone. Bye.